Welcome to the Psych Experience.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Psych Experience, the podcast for those who love psychology and psychiatry. Dr. Nadi, we spoke a few times about prescribing medications with, abuse potential to psychiatric patients. And you told me about a divide, meaning that part of the prescribers are not willing to go there and another big part of them is okay with it.
Yeah, that's a fair description. And one could also say there are different degrees of being okay with the idea of prescribing medications with abuse potential.
Meaning giving special circumstances or solid data?
Yeah.
Now, surprisingly, there seems to be the same kind of split regarding the care of patients with substance issues, substance use issues, right?
Yeah. One could say that and by that, I mean the surprisingly part, one would expect, but yeah, there is the same split.
I see. So what's the landscape and what are the positions for those providers?
Okay. So, all right. So to start, I want to just make a full disclosure. I'm not a square guy, right? I'm a weird breed of nerd. I'm not a kind of a do not have chemical fun kind of doctor. But we also have to remember that we have a sea of people out there who drinks a little bit and they have a whole lot of fun and they smoke here and there and enjoy it, without what we would call clinical consequences. Mm-hmm. I have countless of friends that enjoy a cigar or two a month. I have met people who do drugs while partying and that's it. Power to you. What we're going to talk here, though, it's about folks that cannot keep it together by any reasons. People who lose their hand and, even when they're having just a bit of chemical fun and they end up on a binge or facing sort of drastic consequences like, losing their jobs and families and etc.
Your point being this is not a moral thing.
Yes. No. Not a matter of values. No judgments. So, So when it comes to prescribing style, for lack of a better word, we will find two extremes. One that is okay prescribing benzodiazepines for chronic alcohol users, stimulants for cocaine users, or different and interesting combinations of those for patients with opioid use disorders. Now, one could claim that this is a nihilistic approach to psychiatry, where really nothing matters. Like, and I heard that from a lot of people, like, the patient is going to use from the streets anyways, or whatever, any equivalent thoughts in that regard, would take that, nihilistic approach in the sense of nothing really matters, to justify prescribing whatever is either requested. And I also heard that a lot from patients. They would say stuff like, Dr. So-and-so would give me whatever I want, and I need someone that helps me stay sober. So, and considering that among the population of patients with addiction, the search for feel-good medications for this, kind of benzos, stimulants, is fairly high. And a lot of people refer to it as a grocery store psychiatry, in a non-flattering way.
Right. So one side is more like nothing matters, here's a candy, let's, move along with life. And the other side is more like clean, quote unquote.
The other side will be more aligned with the available knowledge and treatment practice of that population. Now, things have been blurred by some factors, but here we go. Traditionally, and if you talk to recovered addicts, there's an overall effort to stay sober, like completely clean. Mm-hmm. Also, if you have a chance to see or read about, say, recovery from alcoholism, you'll find there's a lot of emphasis on changing your lifestyle, including friends, if your friends are sort of bottle friends. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have to maintain sobriety not only from alcohol, but also from other mind-altering substances that could get you going. Like, just like a first sip would lead to someone falling off the wagon, any sort of intoxication could or would do the same. The other aspect that involves lifestyle changes may be related to limit the amount of temptation that one can be exposed to. Like, sort of, please don't have booze in your house if you're trying to stay sober. And of course, there are things that sort of mud the water. For example, Suboxone and methadone therapy. Mm-hmm. It's not clean, but provenly helps patients who fail to be clean. you know, to have some degree of stability and live a life and sort of a quality of life.
Right, but we also saw that the logic does not apply to benzos for alcohol, stimulants for cocaine, or street stimulants.
Right, there's some data on gabapentin facilitating alcohol sobriety, but does not seem to be enough for a clear recommendation at this point. So, mm-hmm. you know...
But isn't gabapentin also a drug of abuse?
Yeah, and the answer is a bit more complex than yes or no. So continuing on your initial question about the landscape and the position of prescribers in this field, on the end where sobriety is valued, where we fear sapping the efforts of patients who are trying to stay sober, there are other medications besides benzos, stimulants, and opioids that could sort of sabotage the patient's efforts, you know. And one of them is gabapentin. So gabapentin seems to be a drug of abuse only for folks who have substance use disorders. And I'm not going to get into the merit of gabapentin as an anti-anxiety agent here, except to mention that there seems to be a scarcity of data to justify how frequently it is prescribed. But overall, if you prescribe gabapentin to Mrs. Smith, a 50-year-old female with no history of abuse, it is unlikely that she's going to get into a vibe of, you know, overtaking it or even freaking out when she runs out of it, even though there are cases described where exactly that has happened. Like this
right.
old, cute little lady, you know, couldn't wean off gabapentin. However, gabapentin is sort of a second-tier drug of abuse for patients with substance use disorder.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I have to disclose that there's not lots of data in that regard, but there's a lot of empirical data observed, you know, everywhere and by more than one person. So a way to explain this thing is when I was working rehab, I realized that, you know, not all patients are invested in staying sober. Some people are in their rehab because they became homeless, other to appease family members and all kinds of conditions like, you know, go to a rehab or I'll kick you out of the house kind of stuff. You know, life is complex. Right. So a lot of those folks are there for the actual help. A lot of them are done with the lifestyle. You know, they're like, oh my God, you're like, you know, if you want to see repetition compulsion or self-sabotaging help happening without a lot of creativity, because people without addiction, we go huge laps to sabotage ourselves and we don't see it. And we are subtle and we're creative and, you know, we do very smart things to stay where we are and make sure nothing pans out in life. Mm-hmm. But when you see someone with a substance use disorder, it's just like a broken record. It's always the same stuff, you know. And some people just say, okay, enough of it. You know, I can't have this anymore. And then they go for help because, of course, if it was super easy to do by yourself, we wouldn't have a whole industry feeding off this mm-hmm. thing. So those guys, you know, to put in perspective and know that what we know about addiction and the fact that it seems to require a specific brain wiring and the way addiction is experienced by a patient with addiction, consider this. How can you, a person without any addiction, relate to a patient with addiction? What does it feel like to have to give up something that seems or is experienced as a biological need? Because that's a proper way to describe physiological dependence. Meaning, look to America and the rate of obesity, right? Sedentarism. Most people pointing their dirty fingers to patients with addiction, you know, claiming that addiction is a weakness or a moral issue, cannot quit ice cream or bacon, even if their lives depended on it, and they frequently do. Now, what other things we can use to relate to substance addiction? You know, what things do we have in our lives that could get close to what it feels like for an addict to quit their drug of choice? Something that they may crave for the rest of their lives, some impulse, like physical, biological impulse or urge that will forever be knocking on the door, but the patient has to choose over and over again, daily, hourly, not to open the door.
It must be sex, right?
Right, sex, right?
It's gotta be, come on.
Yeah, if you have no addiction and you like to picture what it is like to give up one, think of yourself giving up sex at the peak of your youth for no good reason. Mm-hmm. A lot of similarities. An addict describes this thing as an urge that the body has. It keeps coming up it comes in dreams. It doesn't matter if you don't expose yourself to temptation, your brain does the job for you at times. You know, you picture things and you have to say no over and over and over and over. 20 years down the road, still knocking on the door as if you were built with that thing.
Right. Wow, that really puts things into perspective, yeah.
And I have spent a lot of time thinking about the comparison, and I could not find a better one yet. So now, if you're trying to quit sex, working at a strip club may not be your best career of choice. You know, if you're a man, and if you're a woman, I don't know, make sure not to be too hot, because temptation will be knocking at the door all the time.
No gabapentin for those patients, right?
You got it. Exactly. You got it. So I cannot tell you how many patients visibly invested in their sobriety asked me, please do not put me on gabapentin, and told me, doc, you know, sort of, and I heard this thing so many times, doc, whatever they tell you, gabapentin makes you high.
Mm-hmm. Any other medication that is second tier, as you called it?
Yeah. So in the second tier expression comes from the fact that, you know, those seem to be the second best choices if the good stuff is not available, you know. Uh-huh. And surprisingly, they seem to include Wellbutrin, Seroquel, and Buspar.
Seroquel? Wow. Yep. That's shocking.
it seems to cause some degree of dissociation if it's snorted or taking large quantities. Hmm. Also, it's frequently used by stimulant users to cool down before going to bed and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That tells us that taking stuff orally is not the same as snorting it. You know, if you look into Wellbutrin, mm-hmm. it's a dopamine and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor.
Like the stimulants, right?
Just like the stimulants, yeah. But with a much slower mechanism of action. Also, bioavailability of cocaine is not that hot if absorbed via GI system. So if you snort bupropion or Wellbutrin, you know, it will give you a high, sort of a baby cocaine, according to some patients.
And I
heard that firsthand. Now, even though we saw that we don't have a reason to believe this medication takes like weeks to have effect, as we discussed in the previous episode about the fallacy of antidepressant take 2 to 4 weeks to have effect is not true. Mm-hmm. The perception of the effect is subtle, mild, and sort of slow. You cannot get addicted to something that you take now and has effects days down the road, as we understand the behavioral mechanism of addiction, meaning the instant gratification or reinforcing properties of drugs, you know, that immediate response is... it's sort of needed for the sake of addiction, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's why snorting is different of taking pills. Now, pharmaceutical stimulants do so. They are quick in terms of action, even when taken orally.
And how about Buspirone?
So Buspar, that lesson I learned the worst possible way. I was working with a guy, very nice fella, but he was clearly not invested in the whole sobriety thing. You know, there was a lot of life circumstances that got him to the rehab. And
No judgments.
You know, a lot of, I just don't want to be part of the problem. That's all that matters. And he was always asking for something for anxiety and claiming that, you know, none of the antidepressants could possibly, you know, work, you know, like whatever. I'd say, how about this? How about that? Or he said, nah, it doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work. And then one day I said, yeah, you know, like, I could, because he was looking for gab and benzos, and I said, man, what I could prescribe is Buspar. And right away he said, oh, I can work with that. Mm. And I was like, oh.
What?
Very enthusiastic.
How come?
And I said, all right, here's your Buspar. And after that, I went to research and sort of, boom, it gives you a high if you snort it.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
That guy knew more about psychopharm than you do, right?
You know, it happens a lot. And it's not rare at all unfortunately, it's not rare at all with people that has that substance use issues. They really get informed about these things in on a first-hand way.
They have easier access to information nowadays, right?
In a sense. Yeah. But I don't think that information is necessarily, you know, all Googled kind of deal. I think, you know, people are just living and learning as they go. Mm-hmm. I had another patient who very blatantly asked me for the good stuff. And when I said no, then he sort of asked me about the second tier stuff. You know, can you put me on, you know, Wellbutrin and gabapentin and Seroquel? Mm-hmm. And I said, nah. And then finally said, you know I can snort anything you prescribe me, right? And he told me he would snort and get high with Thorazine, which is, of all things, a dopamine antagonist, and but has a lot of anticholinergic effects. And a lot of people do snort or overtake Benadryl for the same impact. So there you have it.
Now, how do you take care of cases like that?
The answer is awfully simple. I guess executing is quite difficult, but the answer is, what do I do for a living? Surely I have no intention of being part of the problem. You know, I know it sounds like a religious crusade in a sense, but I will not work in a rehab setting and provide patients with substances that they could feel tempted to abuse. Like, come on, you know, so what do? You say, you know, you can call the patient on it. You say, come on, buddy, seriously? Because, you know, patients frequently know what's happening. And some will try to, you know, but a lot will look at you and say, yeah, all right, like, you got me. You know, it happens a lot. And so what you have to do is, you know, I haven't figured any better way. And the absurdities going out there in that sense are a bit too much, but I haven't figured anything better than just say no and say, you know, I'll be available in case you change your mind. We never know when that commitment is going to happen. I have seen people get into rehab saying, nah, just need a place to stay. And within a few days, something happens and they seem to turn around and actually be looking for actual, help. So I think the simple answer is we have to be able to say no. You know, the same way I would not employ someone trying to embrace celibacy in a strip club.
Are there arguments against that approach?
You'd be surprised. Huh. But there are virtually insane arguments and some other quite decent ones. One insane even made to a publication claiming that prescribing benzos to patients on opioid maintenance therapy, like methadone or Suboxone, increases their compliance. Of course it does.
What?
Yeah, if the patient doesn't show up, he may die of withdrawal symptoms. So he made a publication, man. It's like someone, like, without, he wasn't wearing a mask, he really made that statement, you know? And I had this conversation with a colleague. And that's the split. Some people have those ideas in the other half of, I want to hope is half. I think, you know, the number of downloads we're getting in our podcast tell us the numbers of people that are reasonable or pretty big.
Oh, yeah.
So, but we were outraged. Like, right? Like seriously, we're going to prescribe another addictive stuff. What's the gain? Oh, he shows up to the appointments more. Really? Oh, good. You know, like, good job, buddy.
When the meds are afraid.
Dude, and that being said, the combination of opioids and benzos, they increase mortality significantly by opioid overdose because of some synergistic effects involving sedation, which sort of potentializes the risk for a respiratory arrest.
Okay. And what about good arguments?
So one that we mentioned before, I'm pretty sure, it seems that treating ADHD in patients with addiction reduces criminality in patients who have substance use issues, but it does not reduce relapses. That's a pretty interesting thing. The relapse continue to happen, but the criminality doesn't seem to be there as much, right? But also, you know, like, the improvement in actual attention measures are quite modest. Obviously, you're having relapses. You know, attention is super feeble. You know, I mean, look at you trying to perform in the morning. You know, you sleep well. You know, you eat well. You have some coffee. You sit in front of a computer to start working. And yet, your attention is not the best, right? We could all have better attention, right? So now you put that three relapses or two relapses in your life, some binge of anything through the week, and see what happens with your attention. Of course, right? So it's not preventing. So what the hell is this, right? And then also it seems, and this is a topic that I'm still not, I still don't know what to think of it. It seems that psychedelic meds have a meaningful impact on substance use cessation. Old and new data, but that's still in the works, and personally, I have to wait more to make, you know, to draw my conclusions, and we have to wait more to have proper guidelines out of it. And probably there'll be all kinds of noise, like with every other medication, you know, mm-hmm. Especially if these molecules, if pharmaceutical company comes with new molecules that are like similar to psilocybin or anything like that, that are patented, then I assure you there'll be like wonderful data out there. Right. About how getting you high is going to prevent you of getting you high. But I'm open. Dude, if the data is good, if it's convincing, if it doesn't have a lot of biases, I don't mind, you know.
So you would be open to it?
I would. I'm open to the data. You know, I'll be honest with you. When I say I'm not square, I'm not square. You know, what concerns me when substances of abuse are labeled medications is that people taking them are usually less careful with them than addicts are. Mm-hmm. Because after all, the doctor gave it to me. Mm-hmm. Do you see the danger that comes with it?
Yeah.
And so, like medical marijuana, you know, cocaine was a prescription med at some point, right? We know Freud's history with it. And,
microdosing.
You know what I mean? And as if that will have no impact on the long term, and now we have the whole research with psychedelics pretty much stopped in the 70s. We're catching up on that right now. I think there's a lot to learn about it. There's a lot of famous people that advocate for the use of it. I suspect they know more about it than medicine will ever know. Mm-hmm. But really concerns me to take something, recreational medication or drug, and put a label and call it a medication in it. Because now, you know, it's a medication, buddy. You don't have to be wise about what you're doing. And on top of that, you know, I do believe in data. If the data, I believe in the truth and all its approximations as better options than blind guessing or magical thinking. And I also believe being part of the solution as opposed to indifference to the problem or being part of the problem. And before someone claims otherwise, I believe there's a market for it, you know. I believe there are people out there, mm-hmm. that are invested in having meaningful lives, feeling things in its plenitude, mm-hmm. Enough to seek help and be helped and be helped in a clean way.
Okay, good talk, Dr. Nadi. I think this was a wrap for today's episode. And I also would like to remind all of the listeners that we have that if you would like to help us to grow our podcast and to share information among the psychology/psychiatry fields, please don't hesitate to share this content with your friends, your family, or even your colleagues from work. And we also have a lot of stuff back on our website. That's anypmi.org. You should definitely go check that out. We have previous episodes for this podcast and other stuff related to psychology and psychiatry as well. Dr. Nadi, any last messages today for our listeners?
Just to say that if we are sounding amazingly excited about our podcast, it's because we are. When we started this thing, we thought we started this project to appease our hearts. That's the truth of it. And we didn't expect neither the number of downloads, nor the emails, nor the feedback that we're having. And what we're finding out is that common sense wasn't as dead as I thought it was going to be, and has been very gratifying. And, if you feel represented by the things we're saying here, if you feel we are part of something, you know, bring as much people under the same umbrella that we're trying to create together. And, hopefully we're going to make a wave and hurt less people and, make a difference really in how things are done nowadays.
Perfectly said. Thank you, Dr. Nadi, and I'll see you next week.
See you then.
This podcast was offered by anypmi.org.